Hello, my friends. Welcome to the podcast series Elbphilharmonie Talk. This is Tom Schulz on the microphone. I've had the wonderful opportunity to converse with Rini Rosnes, who is the head and the founder of a sextet, a jazz sextet, improvised music. She's a pianist and her band's name is Artemis. And she's performing tonight in the Grand Hall of the Elbphilharmonie, and we just took a good half hour out of her time this afternoon to talk about the band and about the history and about the women in music and the men in music. Enjoy.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
So very warm welcome, dear Rini Rosnes. I'm very happy that you take the time to converse with me a little before you're going to perform tonight with Artemis. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So welcome. So tonight we're going to hear and experience a six women all-star kind of band format. And I try to remember how many female artists, jazz improvising artists, did we have so far in our hall. We would have had Maria Schneider Orchestra, which had to be cancelled due to COVID. And I wouldn't really recall too many feminine female band leaders. And it feels like it's about time to have you coming here.
Thank you.
And I wonder, I mean, you're on the scene for quite some time, and you have been playing in the 90s and maybe even earlier with great jazz musicians. How long did it take to kind of establish a kind of, it's a given now that women are leading bands, that women are performing on that scale as you do?
Yes. I mean, I've always felt accepted, strangely enough, even from the time I began when I moved to New York from Canada, Vancouver, Canada. I began to work quite quickly with people such as Joe Henderson and Wayne Shorter and J.J. Johnson. So I was touring Europe as a side person, side woman, whatever you like, from an early, you know, early on in my career. I didn't really feel any kind of ostracized at all for being a female, because I think that the people I was working with were all very supportive and encouraging and just, you know, my bandmates, my colleagues. It's more almost the media that I feel is more interested in the subject than the women musicians ourselves. Of course, that being said, it is also true that there are fewer women than men who play jazz in particular, and especially certain instruments such as maybe the drums or saxophone, trumpet. It's maybe has been more common for women artists to be pianists or singers, of course.
That's been the history for decades.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But now, in 2022, there are so many young women who are playing. They're just coming out of the woodwork, so to speak, you know. And it's not unusual to hear really very talented young female players coming along, more so now than ever.
That's very true. And I think it also applies to classical music, you know,
yes.
Because Elbphilharmonie, of course, does present lots of classical musicians. And it always used to be like the harpists in the orchestra. Then came the violinists. And now you have timpani and percussion, and you have trumpet, and you have all kinds of instruments coming more and more.
Yes.
And also on a soloist level. So it's really emerging. Plus women composers.
Yes,
who
that's
have been
very important.
Like non-existent, or maybe to the common knowledge, non-existent in the past.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think women composers have always existed. Think about Hildegard von Bingen, you know. We go back a ways. It's just the exposure level has been quite low. And even within jazz, I think it's, you know, Maria Schneider certainly is leading the way, but there's many women, myself included, who compose. And in this band, certainly, everyone has written music for the band. So it's just a matter of time, I think, before it becomes more commonplace and not so so much of a novelty to see women playing together, hear women playing together and playing their own compositions.
You are absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to ask you whether you remember when you played last time in Hamburg?
Oh gosh, it's been a long time. I can't remember.
Because I have this faint memory that you played with this all-feminine band with Wayne's in the late 80s.
I did, but that wasn't an all-woman band. It was Terry Lynn Carrington and myself.
Was it just the band that you have on your website, the video snippet, which was recorded in Frankfurt, I think, with the second keyboard player?
Bernard Wright and Keith Jones on bass and Wayne.
And Terry Lynn.
Three men, two women.
Right. But didn't he have also like even more women in the band at some point? Maybe you weren't...
I don't know. I know he's used women musicians quite often. Yeah. You know, Marilyn Mazur, I know,
exactly.
Played with him. Rachel Z. You know, various people.
But then on that tour, you can't remember having been in Hamburg with
oh,
this
I
Wayne
was
band.
With
you
Wayne.
Were.
I do remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe, is it Club Fasching?
No, Fasching is in Oslo, I think.
No.
Fabrik, you mean.
Fabrik, yes.
The wood structure.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
yes.
exactly
does that
what
still
I mean.
Exist?
It does exist.
Wow.
It still exists, yeah. It has undergone some changes, you know, in terms of programming
right.
and stuff, but it still mm-hmm. works. And I mean, this is one of the revered places for jazz in Hamburg in the 70s, 80s, 90s, I would say. So, yeah, but maybe I heard you there for the last time, which
you
is
could
a
have
shame.
That's
again.
A few decades ago.
More than three decades ago, I would say, like late 80s or so.
Yeah, 88. It would have been 1988, yeah.
But then, I mean, of course, back then there were musicians who would have women players in their bands. But mm-hmm. having a band like Artemis now, mm-hmm. sextet of six outstanding soloists, mm-hmm. would not have been possible, I think, maybe even 10, 15 years ago. Would it?
I don't know. When you say wouldn't have been possible, I'm not sure what you mean. You mean that the bands wouldn't have existed or that they wouldn't have been able to perform?
I think even both. I wonder, maybe they would have existed, mm-hmm. you know, you would have scratched them together from all over the mm-hmm. place to form the band. Mm-hmm. And then the willingness
yeah.
of
right.
the public, of presenters mm-hmm. to say, wow, that's what we're going to
have
next.
Well, you know, I always like to make the point that this particular band of Artemis, we initially came together as an all-female band at the behest of a French promoter who asked if I would help him put together an all-female band to celebrate International Women's Day in Paris and Luxembourg.
8th of March, which year?
Then 2016.
Okay.
Yeah. And I chose a band, and it's mostly the same band, but we had Terry Lynn Carrington on drums and Linda Mahan Oh on the bass.
On the bass, yeah.
And of course, they were very busy. And we enjoyed performing together, and I felt like, wow, there's a lot more. You know, we just scratched the surface of what we were doing, but we all had a very good time playing together and a lot of chemistry. So the following year in 2017, we embarked upon a 14-city European tour. And at that point, that's when Alison Miller came in and Noriko Ueda on the bass. And, you know, it's really all about the chemistry. We're not playing together because we are all female. We're stayed together and are playing together because we love playing together. We love making music. And the music is just, you know, growing and fresh. And there's so many possibilities. And with a band like this, you know, everybody has their own lives. They're all leaders as well. So it's difficult to find the time to carve out to say, okay, this
where you collectively
this
could
is going
go
to,
on
yeah,
tour.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a challenge in terms of, you know, availability and making things happen. But other than that, you know, we're playing together because we're having a great time playing together. It has nothing to do with the fact that we're women. And if you think about it, when would you ever ask a male musician, you know, anything about their gender in terms of the music?
I know.
You don't even think about it. And that's my hope. that in the future, hopefully sooner than later, you know, there will be just, it just won't be a thing. You won't think about it. It's just, it's either a great band, you like the music, you don't like the music. It's not about whether they're, you know, what gender.
Yeah. But then subjectively for you, this is 6 years now in the making of the band, mm-hmm. from 2016 to now.
It's true.
And I would still argue to say, well, this is maybe on the threshold between novelty and becoming normal.
Yes.
Do you feel that too?
I do. But I also feel like there are more and more bands coming out, like I said. And I just hope that in the future, and co-ed bands too. I mean, I'm not saying you have to have a band of all women. This just happened this way, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It is still a newer thing for audiences to see. But I think, in terms of the musician community, can't speak for everybody, but I feel that we are supported and that the music is the bottom line. The music transcends gender.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I think that, you know, the power of the music, the power of what we do as a band speaks for itself.
And hasn't it always transcended this gender thing?
Yes, but I don't know that the promoters or, you know, the business side of the music is as accepting as audiences are. I feel that audiences are very enthusiastic and welcoming. And actually, you feel, I think it's powerful, you know, just to see women playing jazz at this high level and hearing them all together on stage. I feel it. I feel the power of it. I feel emotional about it lots of times when I'm playing with them, because I'm not used to playing with all women. You know.
I find that important that you say that, because, of course, on one hand, it should be normal, and on the other hand, it's still exceptional.
Yeah.
And to really feel both sides of it, I think, is very important.
Yeah.
And to acknowledge, and the pride that also must go with it, to say, listen, this is just world class what we do, and it's about time you hear. And I can swear to you that many people in the audience will just love that fact and say, oh wow, finally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's taking place. I mean, jazz history is over 100 years old. And what did we have, you know, in terms of, of course, pianists, singers.
Right.
But even then, I mean, I remember Carla Bley, you know, she would grab journalists by the throat when they were asking her. So how is the feminine approach to jazz?
Right. I would respond with, how is the male approach to jazz?
I think she was past responding this way because she had been asked the question too often,
right.
You know, and she was just so tired.
It's just music. It's just music. Yeah. We're all communicating with each other. We're having a conversation with each other.
Yeah.
You know.
I love this, and I really want to talk about the music a bit, and also about the lineup. I mean, you have a very unusual combination, I find, with these three horns, because clarinet in this context is quite different than, of course, you would have this hard bop quintet thing, you know, trumpet, saxophone. The clarinet kind of changes it.
Yeah, and it's the really sonority different. Of the instrument. But it fits in very well. And I think maybe sometimes people are a little surprised to hear it in such a modern context. You know.
Post Jimmy Jeffrey and.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, the musicians were chosen just because I loved their playing. So, you know, I had no fears or trepidation about how it would come together.
Yeah.
Even before we played together.
And have you heard all the women on stage and or records or
different
recommendations?
Different places.
Yeah.
I'd never played with Allison before. I'd never played with Noriko before. Ingrid and I, we come from the same part of Canada and British Columbia, but we hadn't done a lot of playing together. I guess Anat really was the one I'd played with the most out of
Anat.
Everybody.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Because of what?
Just because we knew each other on the scene a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
You know, there was more opportunity. We made a tour of Japan with Louis Nash and Peter Washington.
Nice.
And, you know, so
we had her brother here recently with his
Avishai.
With his wild quartet. They couldn't come with the second drummer, COVID. You know, he was just hit with COVID just the day before. So it was only Civ, which was of course still very, very dense and intense and very mind-blowing, I found.
Wow.
Two guitars and then trumpet, and what you can do with a guitar today is quite outstanding.
Right.
But back to Artemis, I mean, knowing that you would work with these women must have instigated a lust for new compositions and new sonorities. This Addington approach, oh, I know these players, I'm going to compose for them.
Of course, yeah.
And this is the case
with
you.
That's the way to write. You know, that's really the only way I've written in the past, a few decades, is you write for the band and for the musicians in particular. You know their sounds, you know what, or you imagine anyway, what they might do with the music. Of course, when you write any composition and you bring it to live musicians, it's going to morph and change and develop even from night to night, which is still happening
Hopefully.
Yeah. So, but I know that all of us had each other's, personalities in mind when we composed for the group.
I totally believe this, and I hear that quite often, and I would like to understand better what that exactly means. Is this just a way of imagining what's going to happen? Or do you have like a little private computer in your head that's enabling you to listen beforehand how Arnaud's going to play this line and how Ingrid is going to come to this? And
I don't think it's so much about the interpretation of imagining the interpretation. I don't really do that. I think it's just imagining the overall sound and the sonority, the group sound.
Okay.
Knowing, just feeling their spirits when you're composing. I don't read too deeply into it. I do have a sense of what it's going to sound like, but it always, like I said, it always changes once you play it anyway. But certainly to write for the musicians that you do, you hear their sound in your head. So whatever that means for each person.
So it's probably like inventing a present that you're making to these colleagues.
In a way, that's a very nice way to put it. Yes, I like that.
And it's about probably the same as you say with the others when they compose for the band, right?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to ask each person, but I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. It's a natural thing to do.
But then when we say there are six composing members of a sextet and they are busy, I mean, how do you choose? Do you have like a serious band book meanwhile where you say, tonight we're going to play these six tunes or these nine tunes? Or is it like the repertoire of the CD more or less and they have to confine and maybe then you rehearse a new piece from someone else? Because you also play cover versions, so...
Yeah. I mean, it changes. The band repertoire is expanding from tour to tour, gig to gig. I always love to bring in new stuff, new arrangements, various, maybe other composers, just whatever I feel might really work. And sometimes we might try something in a rehearsal and feel like, it's not really what we thought. It's not maybe not so great, So we experiment. But I generally make a set list from night to night, and I draw it from the big repertoire. So it changes from night to night.
Yeah. So this, I would dare to say, ancient concept of a band leader still works also in an all-female band.
Well, I think of myself more as an organizational force.
Okay.
I think somebody has to make the decisions in terms of a set list and how we're going to move through the evening, but I'm not a dictator, so.
And I could imagine that the colleagues are quite grateful for that because then they don't have to take care of this aspect.
That's probably true. Yeah. But I welcome suggestions, and if somebody's uncomfortable with something, I try and avoid that. So.
Yeah. So you don't feel like a top-down person that's just saying.
Yeah.
This is how it's going to be.
Right.
Yeah. Now, we have had those, I don't want to converse too long about this dreadful two COVID years, but of course, literally, mathematically, one third of your lifespan with Artemis was pretty restricted, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
How did that work for you?
I mean, all of us, all musicians were, really confined to our homes for a long time. everybody just dealt with it in their own way. You know, I mean, it's not like the band wasn't working. Nobody was working, playing with anybody. So it was obviously very challenging for everyone, and each of us experienced it, I'm sure, in a different way. I mean, I'm just grateful we're here now and hoping that things will continue to open up. Knock on wood,
that yeah, it does. Absolutely.
I mean, for me personally, I was able to, during the time, at least for the year, the year where I was really in the house, I was 21. Writing, trying to stay creative, and I kind of looked at it as a gift, having the gift of time, which I love composing, and I don't always have a lot of time to do it. Plus, which I'm married to Bill Charlap, another pianist, so the house is always full of music. So to be able to have some solitude to actually just relax and not worry about deadlines or rushing off to catch a plane, it was kind of nice in a way.
That's the lighter side of what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wrote.
And you didn't fall into a motivation down.
Not at all.
Cool.
I always feel like I don't have enough time to do everything. So.
Because there are so many musicians who just, you know, almost, you know, got into, or literally felt into depression because,
yeah,
you know,
the
basic nourriture wasn't there anymore.
Yes.
You know,
the nourishment of the
audience,
yeah,
and being on in their set ways, you know,
yeah,
where's the next airport, where is the venue, when is the sound check going on? And,
yeah.
So that didn't occur
for
to
me,
you?
No. I think I learned that I'm quite comfortable. I'm being on my own and introspective. It's fine, natural for me, versus my husband, who felt more anxious about not being out in front of, you know, playing, performing. Of course, I missed that a lot, but I was happy just working on, you know, I just have faith that things are going to get better all
you
the time.
You could do without for a while.
Yeah, it was okay. And so I wrote an album and I recorded it.
Which is fantastic, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great music, I find.
So I felt like I accomplished something, you know.
So you made good use of the time.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was going to continue that way, I could see falling into a depression because we've all had enough of this now and we're all ready for this to be over and to
and
get
I think
back
one
to
has to
lives.
Admit that for a pianist, maybe it's still a little easier because you have your complete, you know, composition tool with you and your improvising tool with you. Mm-hmm. I have seen Ingrid's video, one of the videos she made from her home, where she just describes how difficult it was for her to keep herself up to maintain her chops.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, as a trumpet player, of course you can do your mm-hmm. exercises, but you are really dependent on interaction,
yes,
especially in the improvised music. And to just do it by yourself is just dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
And then to keep the technical level.
Mm-hmm.
So I really admire that a lot.
Yeah.
And I think maybe pianists have a lighter sort, so mm-hmm. to speak, in comparison to to other instruments.
And if you have a partner who's a musician, I think that helps. I mean, Ingrid's husband is a great drummer, John Wicken. So he, you know, I know they were playing together. And Anat also is with a wonderful Brazilian guitarist, Marcelo. So they, you know, she spent a lot of time in Brazil, in Rio,
with him
and playing together.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I must ask you a bit about Bill Charlap because I totally love what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, I think, 15, 20 years ago when I discovered his work. I mm-hmm. did radio back then, and then later on I came here and I kind of lost a bit track. I know your duo record you made, you know, with mm-hmm. this beautiful Chagall thing, this dreamy, very intricate duet work, and his new record, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really play on a regular basis, the two of you, in your living room on two grands? Is this the image?
I mean, it's always there, and we're home a lot these days, so sure, we'll play together. It's not something we talk about or have to set a schedule for, especially during the last few years. Of course, in our regular lives, we're usually so busy we don't have time. He's gone or I'm gone. He teaches as well. So, you know, life gets in the way. But we play together quite often at home and enjoy it. And we do concerts as well. We have yet to do a European tour of the two pianos.
I think because I can't
remember.
This would
be a perfect place, being that we're both Steinway artists. The Hamburg.
I have to admit, we had one piano duo, jazz piano duo with Chucho Valdez and Gonzalo.
Oh, sure.
Which was wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, they took the lids away from the piano.
Yes.
And it was magnificent. Yeah. It was really magnificent. So I will hope for you to come, mm-hmm. because Bill is such a stylist on the piano, also, mm-hmm. I find, and his way of dealing with the Great American Songbook, mm-hmm. and this is so sophisticated.
He comes by it very naturally. His father was a great composer, Moose Charlap, who was responsible for the Broadway production of the music Peter Pan.
Oh.
Yeah, and his mother is still with us, Sandy Stewart, and she still sings, but she was with the Benny Goodman Orchestra for a long time, and she was a regular cast member of the Perry Como show.
Right.
So she's, you know, she did a lot of...
So that's also where his deep steeping in the tradition comes
Absolutely.
From.
Absolutely. He grew up with it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And actually his mother and he made a beautiful duet album on Blue Note called Love Is Here to Stay.
Oh, nice.
And you should find it
if
you're a fan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because she sounds gorgeous.
Wonderful.
And the two of them together. She's 84 now. Yeah.
Wonderful. How did you two get together then, Bill and you?
Well, we were acquaintances on the scene for many years and became closer friends when we both took part in a 10 pianist tour. Not 10 pianos playing together, but 10 pianists
one after
on
the
a
other,
show.
Or sometimes
sometimes
three of them.
Duo. We play trio and solo in Japan. It's called the 100 Gold Fingers Tour. It existed for quite many years. It doesn't exist anymore. But with the likes of, the first time, I did it twice, but the first time, you know, Tommy Flanagan and Mulgrew Miller, Kenny Barron, Ray Bryant, Junior Mans, Gene Harris, Benny Green, Cyrus Chestnut, Roger Calloway, a lot of great pianists. So, we played some two pianos together there and found we had some chemistry.
And was it first the musical chemistry going that you
yes.
said, wow, oh, nice, very yeah. nice. So you are playing now with Artemis in 8 European cities, mm-hmm. quite far away one from another. Mm-hmm. I just looked it up on the map. You started, mm-hmm. I think, in Milan.
Madrid,
in Spain. Yeah. And then you go up to the way, way, way north
Evian.
Of Norway. You were in Evian?
Yeah. We haven't been to Norway yet.
No, I know. Yeah. This is going
right.
ahead of you. You were in Madrid and in Evian, and you mm-hmm. were in
Milan.
And now this is the fourth stay on the leg up yeah. to the north.
Yes.
And have you been playing in all these cities before, or is it Hamburg we spoke about, but the other?
The band played, I believe, before we played in Madrid. I don't think we didn't play in Milan. We've been in Norway, but that was the Molde Jazz Festival. Right.
Yeah. Because this time it feels like it's mostly like standalone concerts. I mean, I think there's one festival, I think, that you're playing, but mm-hmm. the others are all... You know, like decent concert, you know, this is the one thing, and it's mm-hmm. very good venues, I mm-hmm. find. I mean, this thing in Evian must have been fantastic.
It's beautiful.
Just
the concert
all
house.
Thing.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was built in 1993, inspired by Rostropovich. You know the
yeah,
story.
Yeah, I know the story.
But it's interesting. It's made out of, I think, cedar and pine and birch with aluminum panels on the ceiling. They weren't able to dig into the ground.
And then
no
you couldn't
foundation.
Touch the rocks and everything.
And yes, the trees, no trees were cut down because they're protecting the springs of Evian. But it was a beautiful sounding hall.
I totally believe that. So
yeah.
it's a wooden box, I
yeah.
guess. And it sounds like a cello from inside. So
yeah. I mean, I think it would be it doesn't feel like you really need microphones. So it's a little bit different when you have drums and, you know,
you
jazz.
Always have to balance.
Yes.
And the bass, of course, needs to kind
right.
of be balanced with it.
Yeah. yeah.
And then going to Norway, I mean, you have lots of experience, I guess, with European audiences, but... Are you familiar with the different responses people give here to improvised music?
Like not in Sweden, really.
They would just, you know, stay put all the time, and they would applause it. And you think, well, they didn't really. And at the end, they would just say how tremendously they enjoyed the show.
Where is this? Here?
In Sweden.
Oh, in Sweden.
In Gothenburg,
okay.
For instance. So.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I was surprised, and I thought, well, as a musician, if you are coming here, maybe you sense it differently as a musician because you feel still there is some rapport going and
some energy
exchange.
Right.
But there is no such thing as exuberance.
Yeah. well, but that's interesting. I mean, I'm Canadian, so I can relate a little bit between Canadian audiences and American audiences, which even as when I was much, much younger, I noticed, they're just more American audiences are more vocal. Canadians are more reserved, more like what I would think Europeans are. As well, depending, I suppose, on what country you're in. The same with Japan. Japan, you know, they're very great listeners.
Super and polite.
Very quiet. But then at the end, they explode. You know? So.
I know. I remember this from Keith Jarrett, how much he loved playing in Japan. Because, I mean, they would treat the artists like kings. And then, of course, the level of attention and,
right.
and willingness to bow
mm-hmm.
before the musician was
right.
always
yeah.
very, very big. So then you were going to finish this tour, and any plans then for a second record?
Yes, we'll be recording in August and for Blue Note, our second album for Blue Note. And we have many other jobs between now and then as well. We're going to San Francisco for 3 or 4 nights. We're doing Chicago Symphony Hall, which will be lovely.
San Francisco Jazz Hall or Jazz Collective?
Yes, Minor Auditorium.
Yeah.
Which is lovely to be back there again because I spent a lot of time with as a
with
Jazz Collective.
Yeah.
But that was before the building was in existence. I mean, the actual SF Jazz, you know.
Yeah.
Built center.
We will have SF Jazz hopefully in June now.
Okay.
It's a third postponed date, meanwhile.
Oh.
You know, we wanted to do the Joni Mitchell tribute with Liz Wright.
Right.
And
yeah.
Now it's all up in the air and the
yes.
material will be totally different. The band has changed the personnel.
Gretchen,
meanwhile.
I think, came in, yeah. Chris Potter,
I
love.
Yeah, Chris Potter. I mean,
he's so great.
Fantastic on this
Blue Note
record of yours. I mean, I always found that he's an exceptional player, but this is so going into the soul of it all. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I love working with Chris because I always feel like when I'm composing and I'm thinking about him or whatever, I always know he can just do anything.
Yeah.
And I prefer not to say anything, you know, do this or think about that, just because I know that he feels the music and how he interprets it or how he plays it is always going to come from the heart. And it's just lovely. It's wonderful to communicate with musically on stage.
Yeah. You had, on the record, you had Melissa, I think, on the tenor saxophone, or you were touring
yes,
with her
that's
for
right.
a while.
Yeah.
Is this just like an open seat for the saxophone that it just... might
it's not
change.
Necessarily an open seat. She wanted to pursue some other things and felt that this might be in the way.
Oh.
So it's okay. I'm happy for her. You know, she's got a new record out on Blue Note as well. So she's doing really well. But in the future, it's possible there will be some changes from time to time. And, I mean, like I said before, the music is what matters. And if we, for me, it's about who are we going to work with that feels right, you know.
So, bold question, you would even imagine that one day Chris Potter might join Artemis for something?
I never thought about that.
Massaging this all-female concept a bit.
Maybe in the future, who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that would be an interesting concept to say, you know, we are not confined to, it has to be all women
right.
in order to
yeah.
work.
Yeah.
Because if he's, that would be the consequent step to
of
say,
course.
If it's really all about the music,
yes.
why not?
No, you're right.
Yeah.
I can't argue with that.
But for now, it'll be this beautiful, wonderful sextet.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I can only say that I'm really very much looking forward to tonight.
Thank you so much.
And to thank you deeply for your time.
Thank you. It was great to be here in this beautiful city of Hamburg.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, René.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.